United States v. Mihaly.
Good morning. My name is Stanley Hill, and I represent the appellant, Jeffrey Mihaly. Your Honor, at a minimum, this case, at a minimum, the defendant should receive a sentence reduction. At the most, he should receive a new trial. If the prosecution is going to use the defendant's alleged statement as evidence against him, the government has a fundamental obligation and duty to accurately inform the trier of fact as to what the defendant said. At trial, Special Agent Conway's recollection of what defendant said during the March 26 interview, which was erased by Special Agent Conway, substantially differed from what Detective Dave Jackson's recollection was. They were the only two witnesses who were present besides my client. Special Agent Conway erased the tape, thus we didn't have that. Special Agent Conway's admitted that my client had stated that Tiffany Ollie had purchased the gun as protection because of fears of the nightcrawler and the rapist who assaulted a woman in the laundry room of her apartment building. On the other hand, Detective Dave Jackson contradicted this on this critical point, and the government never brought it to the trier of fact's attention that Dave Jackson had misspoke. Specifically, I asked on cross-examination of Detective Jackson, on March 26, during that interview, Jeffrey Mihaly told you that the protection was for the nightcrawler, didn't he? No, sir, he did not. On March 26, Jeffrey Mihaly told you the protection asked for the fact that there had been a rape in the building, didn't he? Detective Jackson, no, he did not. So if Agent Conway said he did, would she be lying or would she be mistaken? I don't know, sir. Absolutely no discussion about the nightcrawler, Mr. Jackson? No, sir. Absolutely no discussion about the rape in the building? No, sir. Now, Your Honors, when the prosecution permits a witness to testify to facts which the prosecution knows to be false, the failure of the prosecution to correct the testimony which he or she knows to be false deprives the defendant of due process of law, even though the prosecution did not solicit the false evidence. Napoo versus Illinois.
Now, this testimony, just so I can get the timeline right, the interview took place in about a year and a half before the trial. Is
March 26, Your Honor, yes.
So that was about a year and a half before the trial.
Yes, but Conway testified before Detective Jackson. And on, first of all, we had made a issue about whether or not there should even be any reference to the statement in light of the fact that it had been erased. And we weren't sure as defense counsel what the government was going to be presenting regarding what the defendant had allegedly said. So, but during my examination of Conway, she admitted that, yes, he had talked about the nightcrawler, and yes, he had talked about the rapist. So before the government put Jackson on, the government knew what Conway had said. And they had presumably talked with Detective Jackson. I'm assuming they talked with their witnesses before they put them on. I guess it's not good to make any assumptions, but presumably they have an obligation to do this, I think. Under Napoo versus Illinois, fundamental fairness requires that the jury be fully and truthfully informed of all of the matters within the knowledge of the prosecution or its agent.
I don't see the prejudice, counsel, because the girlfriend testified that she didn't purchase the gun because of the nightcrawler. She purchased the gun for your client, who then sold it to his ex-con friend.
Yeah, that's correct.
So where's the prejudice?
The prejudice is that the jury has a right to know what the defendant said. If they're going to use his statement, see, they use the defendant's statement as evidence against the defendant. I mean, granted,
but the jury was told what the defendant said.
Yeah, but the jury was left with a question about what the defendant had said because Detective Jackson denied that he'd said that. I mean, you can't have it both ways. I mean, either he said it or he didn't. They erased the tape, so we don't have an accurate statement of what the defendant did say. Tiffany Conway says that he said it, that he clearly said it. She was the case agent on it. She was the person who had last heard what the defendant said before it was erased. And then the government allows Detective Jackson's testimony to come in unexplained. Prejudice is presumed when the government allows a lie to go uncorrected in the record.
That's not the law. You have to show prejudice for a Brady violation to be reversible. I thought this was all couched in the context of a Brady claim.
That's the first argument. The argument that we're talking about now is the Napu versus Illinois argument, which deals with the fact that the attorney for the government is the attorney for the people, and as such has an independent duty to seek justice even when it may hurt his case. That's another line of cases. That's another line of cases that say we're not talking Brady violation. We're talking what is the obligation of the prosecutor to put on a case when putting on a case.
What is the evidence that the detective committed perjury, if that's what your claim is? Am I reading you correctly? That you've moved on to the allegation that the detective committed perjury?
Whether he committed perjury doesn't go to Jackson. It goes to what the government allowed to stand. This goes to the prosecution's conduct. Napu versus Illinois talks about what is the obligation of a prosecutor. I'm not talking about Detective Jackson. Maybe Jackson's memory was suspect. Maybe he had forgotten. But the prosecutors knew definitely what the situation was.
Well, they knew that there was a discrepancy in the testimony, or maybe they didn't. Whatever, that's what I'm asking. What evidence is there that the government suborned perjury here, which sounds like what you're suggesting?
The prosecution knew what Conway had told them. The prosecution knew that as a result of pretrial motions that we had filed regarding keeping the statement out. There was some question about whether or not the witnesses should even be allowed to say anything about what Mihalik had said. Because the way it was presented to the defense in discovery, they suggested that it was a confession. They suggested that what we were getting as a result of that March 26th statement was a confession. We later find out that, no, it's not a confession. It's an exculpatory statement if you allow the references regarding the nightcrawler as well as the rapist to come in. Because what he said was that the gun was purchased by Tiffany Ollie because of her fears regarding the nightcrawler and the rapist. The way the statement was presented to us in pretrial discovery was that the gun was purchased for their protection. That's what we got. During my examination of Conway, I find out for the first time in the middle of the trial that, she did. It was as my client had stated. It was because of the nightcrawler and the rapist.
Yes, sir. She means Agent Conway.
Yes, sir.
That Tiffany purchased a gun for both of them. That's a transcript 385. I mean, that's her testimony. And then when Mr. Jackson's testifying, he said, the question is posed to him, on March 26th, Jeffrey Mihalik told you the protection as for the fact that there had been a rape in the building, didn't he? No, he did not. So if Agent Conway said he did, would she be lying or would she be mistaken? But I don't see that is directly contrary to what she said.
No, Conway testified that she omitted from her report references to the nightcrawler and the rapist. She confirms what my clients, what I'm representing here. She actually confirmed that. She said she omitted it. She said, I apologize. I omitted the references to the nightcrawler. I omitted the references to the rapist. I omitted that. She came clear, and she was honest and very candid about that fact. Then when Jackson gets up, he comes in and unequivocally states no reference at all to that. Now, it's our position that Jackson came after Conway. The prosecution, what we're talking about, our criticism goes to What is the obligation of the prosecution in a criminal case? I'm submitting that I'm agreeing with the ABA Code of Professional Responsibility, which says that the prosecutor is the attorney for the people, and as such has an independent duty to seek justice even when it may hurt his case.
So you're saying that the prosecutor should not have put him on the stand?
I'm saying that after they heard what he's
one aspect.
I'm saying that after they heard what he had to say, there should have been some representation made that, you know, he was incorrect regarding that, or his memory faltered, was wrong about that. You can't just let it stand uncorrected, especially when they know that there's that discrepancy, especially when they know about the problems with the erasure of the tape and the disability that the defense was placed upon the defense, because we didn't have an accurate statement regarding what the defendants had said during that interview. I mean, what's their obligation? Just to stand by and allow contradictory evidence that they know is contradictory and wrong to come in without correcting it?
Trials are full of contradictory evidence.
Yeah, but the prosecution is more than just an advocate. I think NAPU versus Illinois stands for the proposition that they've got to go further than to just, you know, just allow testimony to come in.
If we assume that what you've said is accurate, I mean, in terms of the prejudice, I'm having trouble getting to that prong because, as I understand it, he was carrying the gun for 2 months on his person before he sold it.
Well,
if the protection, as you said, is supposed to be, as she said, as Conway said, got it for the night crawler, got it for protection for both of them, and he carries it for 2 months.
He never made an admission that he carried it, Your Honor.
That was some of the evidence the government presented.
That was evidence that the government, never admitted that
he
carried it.
I understand that. But what I'm saying is there was evidence that was shown to the jury that he carried it on his person for 2 months before selling it.
Well, the statement was that, I mean, this guy Foster, the way it played out was that it was supposed to have been a gun that was purchased by Tiffany Ollie because of the Nightcrawler and the rapist. The gun was in her apartment. They didn't live together. He lived at a place different than where Ollie lived. Now, at one point they were together, at another point they weren't, but the gun was supposed to have been at Tiffany Ollie's house. When Tiffany Ollie moved, it was the defense's contention that Samuel Foster helped in that move, and that Samuel Foster stole the gun, and that's how he got the gun. Not that it was sold by the defendant, that Samuel Foster stole the gun when he helped Tiffany Ollie move in November.
Yeah, I think the testimony the government presented was Ollie testified that she never touched the gun after the purchase and that Mihalik began carrying it around. So that's how that evidence came into the record.
That's correct.
All right.
That's correct. The other point that I'd like to raise is, like I said, if not a new trial, then certainly a reduction in sentence. There was double counting here. Judge Gottschall did not find any additional facts to justify the imposition of an upward adjustment. Judge Gottschall imposed an upward adjustment premised on the same conduct as the underlying base offense. Therefore, Mihalik's base offense should be reduced by 4 points from level 24 to level 20, with a resulting sentence of 63 months instead of the 92 months imposed. Judge Gottschall stated was that I am, and this is stated at transcript 13, sentencing transcript, I am adding this adjustment only on the basis that the evidence was clear that Mr. Mihalik had information that Mr. Foster had a felony background, and there was nothing in the record suggesting any illicit purpose. And that's all I'm willing to find. Well, that's what the underlying offense is based upon. So what I'm asking for is that if you don't give him a new trial, at a minimum, he should get a sentence reduction.
Well, you're leaving out the next couple of sentences. She goes on to say there's absolutely no way to imagine that Samuel Foster had illicit use for this gun. He's a bad actor, he's a street guy and a gang member, and he does crimes. At a minimum, he was going to have that gun with him somewhere he wasn't supposed to be to have the gun with him.
She's got to make that finding, though. She didn't make a finding.
That's what that is.
No,
she doesn't have to say, I'm announcing this as my finding. She says that he's going to do crimes with it.
She states that sentencing transcript 13, line 25, and that all I'm willing to find, mm-hmm. all I'm willing to find, is that Foster had a felony background and that there's nothing in the record suggesting any illicit purpose.
And
now
that
she
means
goes
that he's
going to
use it for an illicit purpose.
Well, illicit doesn't,
for the enhancement.
Illicit doesn't mean felony. Illicit does not mean felony. You have to find that he was going to use it to commit a felony. Now, illicit has several... Now, the red light is on, but illicit has several connotations, many of which don't mean felony, I would submit. In order to enhance, you've got to find that he was going to use it to commit a felony. That's what you've got to show. That's what the guideline specifies, and I'm asking for a reduction because there's no evidence that he was going to use it for a felony, and that's what you've got to make a finding of, and she didn't make that. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Nagel?
If it pleases the court, good morning. My name is Patrick Nagel, and I represent the United States of America, the appellee in this matter.
Yeah, and can you begin with the last point on this whole double counting? Because you barely mentioned that in your argument. And wasn't the district court's heavy reliance on Foster's status as a felon duplicative of the charge of selling a gun to a felon?
And, Your Honor, our position is that this is not a case of double counting because while the defendant was convicted of selling a firearm to another known felon, that in and of itself, that conviction, that count of conviction, had nothing beyond the fact of knowing that the person he was transferring the gun to was a convicted felon at the time when he gave him the gun. The enhancement under Sentencing Guideline 2K2.1B5 also has the added element that when that transfer of the gun is made, that the transferor, in this case the defendant, had reason to believe that the gun would be used or possessed in connection with another felony offense.
That's what, as counsel pointed out, she didn't make that finding.
Well, we would submit that she did make the finding and that what the judge said when she says there is absolutely no way to imagine that Foster had illicit use for this gun, she says illicit use, meaning the use for the gun was illicit. And then if you read in the context of what she's saying, he's a bad actor, he's a street guy and a gang member, and he does crimes. She made it clear that when she says he has no illicit use, that the defendant knows that the use for the gun is an illicit one, and there certainly was...
I know if we would do as counsel for the defendant suggests and send it back, she could make that finding, mm-hmm. or you could make that argument, but mm-hmm. she didn't make a felony finding mm-hmm. here.
Well, Your Honor, what we would submit is that although maybe in terms of the artfulness of the way she made her finding... what she was saying in making the finding was that, in fact, there was reason to believe that the defendant or that the Mr. Foster had used the firearm for to commit a felony offense. Reason to believe, and certainly substantiated in the record and the evidence presented both at trial and at sentencing, and in the context of the sentencing argument and of the other facts that came forth and that were part of this discussion. Clearly, that's what she meant when she said...
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Finish your thought. I'm sorry, counsel.
I finished.
All right. When you look at her words, though, even if she relied on other factors like Foster's gang membership, doesn't that go to the same point as selling the gun to a felon? I mean, the whole reason we won't let felons have guns is because they're going to commit more violent crimes, right?
In terms of the policy behind the statute itself, I would assume that is the fact. However, in this case, what we had were a confluence of events where under the guideline enhancement, basically the enhancement talks about Is there reason to believe that one person, when giving a gun to another convicted felon, would have reason to believe that that convicted felon would then use it for a felony offense? And in this case, we submit that the defendant in this case, more than anyone else, should know that Mr. Foster would use this gun in the commission of a felony, in that the two individuals had known each other for a decade, had met in prison, had served sentences in two different state penitentiaries, were members of the same street gang, had used drugs together, both PCP and cocaine, and in fact had negotiated when they made the negotiation for the sale of this gun, had originally talked about using an 8-ball of cocaine in exchange for the gun. Mr. Foster had himself committed acts of violence in the defendant's presence and had committed acts of violence against other members of the gang.
But of course, all this you're laying out for us, the district court didn't make specific findings on. I mean, the district court didn't mention of that.
I think when the district court says he's a bad actor, he's a street guy and a gang member, and he commits crimes, I think that's sort of a summary of all the evidence before the court regarding these matters.
Do you think there's a presumption here that a defendant has reason to believe if a defendant has reason to believe a gun will be used for another crime when he sells that gun to a convicted felon?
No, not in and of itself. However, the specifics of this case were two individuals who had a personal relationship, who knew each other for a long period of time. When the person who was transferring the gun to the transferee, in this case the defendant to Mr. Foster, knew Mr. Foster's character, knew Mr. Foster was heavily involved in drugs, involved in violence, and that Mr. Foster here at the age of 28 was a 6-time convicted felon, 3 drug convictions, 2 gun convictions, a battery conviction, and that, in fact, weeks later, Mr. Foster then did use the gun in connection with a shootout with a third-party individual. I mean,
And you've laid out very cogent reasons as to why it's not just a repeat of the underlying offense itself, but, again, the district court never laid that out in that way. Other than this one reference that you made, he's a bad actor, he's a street guy, gang member, he does crimes.
The district court had a more abbreviated summary of the very evidence that I had laid out, that was laid out by the prosecution at the sentencing.
Could have been more thorough.
Yes, Your Honor. I would also point out, though, too, in noting that the relationship in the weeks prior to the sale of this gun between the defendant and Mr. Foster also involved the defendant acquiring ammunition for another gun owned by Mr. Foster, as well as repeated references to the guns and the showing and brandishing of guns between these two convicted felons over the course of a several-week period leading up to the sale of the gun. And our argument is that clearly the defendant had reason to believe that this gun was going to be used in the commission of a felony, in that the defendant himself had committed several felonies Mr. Foster had committed several felonies in the defendant's
presence.
So that would be our position on that. With regard to the other issues that the defense has raised, there is no evidence Detective Jackson committed any perjury, that the government knew of any perjury, or that the alleged perjury affected the trial's outcome. What we have here is a simple case of two different individuals who were both present during an interview that occurred a year and a half before the trial, who had slightly different recollections of what was said during that interview. And I think that it's very reasonable that during a 30 or 40-minute interview, that two people a year and a half later might not recall exactly the same things that had been said. In this case, there was testimony by Agent Conway that the defendant had mentioned the nightcrawler, not that the defendant had said that Tiffany Alley purchased a gun because she feared the nightcrawler. That wasn't the testimony of Agent Conway. Her testimony was merely that he had mentioned the nightcrawler. Her testimony, in addition to that, was that during that same conversation that the defendant had said that the gun had been purchased for his and his girlfriend, Ms. Ali's, mutual protection. That in and of itself is the inculpatory statement, and that's what's needed for the conviction for possession of a firearm by a prohibited person. The fact that the defendant also said or mentioned the nightcrawler, even if he had said that the gun was purchased because of fears of the nightcrawler, at best that's a self-serving, false exculpatory statement, because as came out at trial, the nightcrawler had been apprehended by law enforcement officers over a month prior to the purchase of the gun.
And so the girlfriend testified that it wasn't because of the night crawler.
And the girlfriend, Ms. Ali, did testify that she didn't fear the night crawler. She didn't want a gun. She purchased the gun because the defendant had filled out a FOID card slip for her, submitted it, had taken her to the gun store, had picked out the gun that he wanted, and that when the gun was purchased, she hands him the box. He opens the box, takes out the gun, carries it on his person for the next several months, cleans the gun, loads the gun with bullets, and ultimately sells the gun to Mr. Foster. That testimony is consistent with Mr. Foster's testimony that he ran into the defendant on the street, and in fact the defendant had the gun on him.
Let me make sure I'm not confused in terms of timing. At the time that this was purchased, the nightcrawler had been caught.
Correct.
Is that correct?
So the nightcrawler,
like a month before, some period before.
The nightcrawler had been caught a month before this event, before the gun's purchase. Also, I would point out that Detective Riley, during the trial, had testified that when the nightcrawler was apprehended, that it was big news in Joliet. It was on the television. It was in the newspapers. And just as defense counsel had noted in his opening statement that the nightcrawler was on the loose in Joliet and that everybody knew about it, certainly it goes, you know, it's fair to say that everybody also knew that the nightcrawler was then apprehended. But we would submit that the nightcrawler as a focus is really a red herring in this case, because it has no bearing on the fact the defendant was a felon in possession of a firearm. And in fact, nobody other than possibly the defendant even suggests the nightcrawler has any relation to or interplay with the purchase of the gun. Are there any questions of the court?
Nope.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I feel your time had expired, so... you also hope you accept the appreciation of the court for your fine representation of your client in this case as well.